This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with Colin Jost and Michael Che, the anchors of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. Their interview was recorded on Monday, November 9th, just 2 days after the controversial episode of Saturday Night Live hosted by Donald Trump. Jost and Che started anchoring Update together at the beginning of last season in the fall of 2014. Jost had been the head writer of the show, but stepped down this season to focus on Update. Che joined SNL as a writer in 2013, but left the following year to become a correspondent on The Daily Show. After 3 months, he returned to SNL to co-anchor Update. Let's start with a Weekend Update clip from the November 7th episode. Jost speaks first.
Well, Ben Carson had a real interesting week. First, he said that the Egyptian pyramids were actually built by the biblical Joseph to store grain. Sure, makes sense. Then he had to defend stories about his violent past after CNN couldn't find anyone to verify them, which is always great when you're running for president and you have to say, "No, guys, I swear, I really did stab my friend."
Yeah, Ben Carson, what is going on with you? You are the first black man in American history to turn down an alibi. That'd be like if OJ said, "Hey, give me that glove back again, man. I think I can make it fit. Let me try my stabbing hand."
And then last night, Dr. Carson lashed out at the media for digging into his past, saying, "What's next? They're going to find my kindergarten teacher who said I peed my pants?" But at this point, Dr. Carson, I think we're more worried it'll turn out you didn't graduate kindergarten or that you claim to pee your friend's pants and then they find your friend and he's like, "I never had pants."
And now Ben Carson is complaining that no one ever vetted President Obama like this. Are you serious, dude? Even after Obama was elected president twice, they still made him show ID just to get into the White House.
And I'm talking about the guy hosting the show.
And in case you couldn't hear Michael Che's final aside there, he said, "I'm talking about the guy hosting the show." Michael Che, Colin Jost, welcome to Fresh Air. What was it like to write for this past weekend's episode, knowing that Trump was on the show and that everyone was watching?
It was strange. It was you can hear it a little bit in that clip. It was a tenser vibe, I thought, in the studio. I don't know if you agree, Michael, but it was like a tenser vibe because it's a political figure that's also there. So it's always strange to then be telling jokes about either the person that's there or other people that he's campaigning against. I think there's like an added level of tension there.
It's always hard in comedy to write for people who's made up their mind. And I mean, the audience, I thought the audience pretty much had their minds made up on, you know, their opinion of him. So they're always looking at everything like, "Wait, is this a trap? Is this joke going to be a trap? Is this joke going to make me like him a lot more? Is it going to make me like him a lot less?" And I thought they were kind of overthinking a lot of the things that we were saying. So the tension, that's where the tension kind of felt.
Well, you got in one of the genuine digs at Trump, Michael, by that last aside that you said. I'm talking about the person hosting the show, meaning let's not forget that Trump was a birther. And that he, you know, insisted that Obama show his birth certificate long after Obama had shown his birth certificate. So Did Trump have the opportunity of vetoing anything on Update? I know he had the opportunity of vetoing some things, at the very least in sketches that he was in.
No, he didn't have any. He had no say in what we did on Update. The interesting thing was, like at dress rehearsal, even that, you know, that bit about Michael's observation about, you know, "Make America Great Again," like, when is again, was actually a lot longer. And we got into more like talking about what era specifically did you want to go back to? Like, was it Industrial Revolution when like women couldn't vote and like toddlers had jobs? Or was it like the 50s or the 80s? And, you know, we went through each era, but you realized it was a little tense at dress rehearsal, and those things, like, Donald Trump didn't have any say in whether we did those things or not, but they just didn't play. like in front of the audience at dress rehearsal.
So it's a live show, so you get to hear the audience enjoy it or not enjoy it when it's on TV. So we kind of write the show for me, at least as a writer, you know, you want a show that plays well to a live audience so that the people at home understand that it's good, that it's fun, we're all in on the joke, you know. So when it dies on air, you know, it's hard to relate it. Then it's just awkward. Then it's just tense. And then the next sketch has to follow that. So you can't kill a room for the rest of the show with something, you know, that might be a little chilling. So you got to, it's a very hard balance to confront something that's important, but also make it fun.
Yeah, and Michael, what you said that actually made it to air about that is like, what era is he talking about? You want to say what you said about that?
I don't know that I remember. yeah, like what specifically? Because when old rich white guys start bringing up the good old days, my Negro senses start tingling.
Yeah,
is that the part?
That is the part. So who is
Negro senses are tingling? I think every minority, even not even minority, because I hate that word minority, but there's always something. I think there's something about everybody that feels like a lot of the world can't relate. And whether it's black or whether it's woman or whether it's sexual orientation or whatever it is, everybody kind of has something except for Colin. And no, but you know, like everybody, literally everybody on the planet has something that they say, well, people don't talk about how hard it is for this. And I feel like there's a lot of times where, you know, Donald Trump is kind of like the poster child of ignoring people that may not have it as good as him. He's like this rich billionaire privileged dude. And I think it would be weird to not address it at some point.
So you were talking about how some of the things didn't play during dress rehearsal. They didn't play to the audience. Was the audience selected differently than it typically is?
I don't think so, really. I don't know. I know there was additional security, but there also was the last show we did because Hillary Clinton was on, and so it's similar. I think there was a similar process of just making sure, there was just a little extra security.
Yeah.
So that adds to it also. But there wasn't any weird selection process.
It was more than Hillary, but less than Prince. If that makes sense.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Colin Jost and Michael Che, the co-anchors of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. Let's get to an example of what you do on a regular week when Donald Trump isn't hosting. So there's a clip I want to play of you both from something you did on Weekend Update about gun control this season. And do you want to say a little bit about what was happening in the news that inspired this?
Well, it was after the Oregon shooting. It was probably a week or two after that. But it was really, it started because there was constant media coverage of it and just constant debates about what to do about gun control.
Okay, so here's an excerpt of Weekend Update with my guests Michael Che and Colin Jost.
Look, here's a list of things that are harder to get than a gun. A driver's license, a purple belt in karate, Kevin Hart tickets, a GED, spray paint.
All right, well, here are things that are easier to get than a gun. Herpes.
All right, why do you say that all the time?
I didn't prepare a list. Look, you know how hard it is to limit guns? Think about how hard it was in New York to limit sodas. Bloomberg was like, maybe just don't drink soda out of a bucket? And people were like, he's trying to take our soda buckets.
Which brings me to my next point. You can't have whatever you want, all right? I know the forefathers said you have the right to own a gun, but they also said you could own people. Which, by the way, if I owned a whole field of jacked Africans, I'd probably want a dozen or so guns too.
It's not supposed to cut to me after that.
Oh, no, it is. I told them to do that. Look, the Constitution, I was making a point.
The Constitution is a lot like our grandfather. He's wise, we love him, and he means well, but he's getting really, really old. And every once in a while, he says something crazy, and we gotta go to the other room and discuss what we're gonna do about it.
And look, you know, as New Yorkers, I don't think that we should be telling the rest of the country how to deal with guns, okay? I don't have a gun, you don't have a gun.
Well...
Wait, you have a gun?
I mean...
Why do you have a gun?
I got a lot of sneakers, Colin. I mean, which one are you doing? Walk home by myself, man.
That's Colin Jost and Michael Che on Weekend Update. So, Michael, do you have a gun?
Well...
I do have a lot of sneakers, though. I don't have a gun.
That was a fun one to do, because I think it was the first time that we kind of just tried doing a back and forth, almost debate kind of between ourselves that mm-hmm. came out of a very real, just us talking through, like, well, what do we think about this?
Tell us more about that process.
Well, that I think what for us, the more what we want to do is make a Weekend Update as much ours and in our voices as it can be. And so that's whenever there's an existing segment on the show like that, I think certainly for me, when I started, I was like, oh, this is how this segment goes. This is the structure of it. But then as we start getting into it, you're like, oh, no, we have to figure out what it is. Again, even though it's an existing format, we have to rediscover what it means for us. And so like that for us, that came from one thing that we did was start just getting in a room and talking through how we feel about different things, and that was the big issue that week. And that's just been helpful week to week for Michael and I to just talk like kind of basically the way we would in normal life if we were trying to figure out jokes as comedians about a subject.
Michael, when you were asked to co-anchor Weekend Update with Colin Jost, you had just started on The Daily Show as a correspondent. You'd been there 3 months.
Yeah.
Was it a hard decision to make whether to stay with The Daily Show where you just arrived or go to Saturday Night Live for Update?
It was a very, very hard decision because, I love The Daily Show. I love, John was fantastic as even letting me consider it, it was a really cool job. And also the Weekend Update, you don't want to just do it. It's not something you just want to put on your resume. You want to do it right. Like, that's one of the reasons why I do comedy, is because of, like, Norm's Update and, SNL. It's such a special thing to me, especially having worked there and knowing how important it is to the show. So I at first was just really debating, could I do this right? Can I do it justice? Is it just something that, I'm doing because it's possible? And then it just became like an exciting challenge, and then it was kind of the best case scenario because I love the cast so much and I love SNL so much, and then working with Colin was going to be so much fun. So it was like, yeah, you kind of have to do it. I mean, how do you say no?
I want to take a little detour here and play the last sketch, Michael, that you were on The Daily Show, and it started out as a report that you were doing on Joe Biden. So here's Jon Stewart introducing you.
For more on Joe Biden's recent blunders, we're joined by senior casual racism correspondent Michael Che. Michael, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. I gotta tell you, Hillary Clinton has to be overjoyed to see a challenger flame out like this.
Are you kidding, John? This is the first real threat to her campaign. I mean, sure, it's nice to have Jews and Asians on board, but if Joe Biden can sew up that old white racist vote, he'll be unstoppable. You got a line, man.
You really think this was a bit we were doing, Joe Biden thing? You thought that was a bit, a segment?
What?
All right. For those, a lot of you don't know this. Today is Michael Che's last day on The Daily Show. No. I know. But he is going to be co-anchoring Weekend Update on SNL. So we're very excited. It's terrific.
Thank you.
We're very excited for Michael. And So we sort of concocted this whole bit. So that he wouldn't know, you know, we were planning a little something for him. Tonight marks kind of the end of an era, and we get to say farewell. You know, it reminds me when John Oliver left in the same way, and it was,
He was here for 7 years.
Yeah.
I've been here for like 3 months.
You were here for, actually 58 business days. You know, Michael, it's fun. I will never forget the first time young Michael Che showed up here at The Daily Show. You fresh-faced kid, must have been, what, 31?
Yeah, man, I'm still 31. It was June.
That's so hilarious.
You know, I've never seen that.
Oh, you're kidding? You have to see it. It's so funny.
I never watched it.
So were you surprised? Like, did you really think it was a Joe Biden sketch, or were you in on it?
No, I was in on it, but I wasn't in on the whole thing. It was actually supposed to be way more elaborate. That was probably the craziest time in my very short young life, I would have to say. Just because I remember like coming from SNL, like I had to run from SNL to The Daily Show to tape that.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Because we were still doing like test shows and stuff, so I had to like run and then go directly into wardrobe and then run through that. So it was really, really hectic and really crazy. And like I said, like that, The Daily Show, I mean, Jon Stewart, he was just such a welcoming, great dude. And they were really, really cool about everything. And I really appreciated them for even doing that episode. They didn't have to do that. I was only there 3 months. It was more of a, the joke was that I didn't deserve it, you know? So that's what made it so much fun, but
the whole segment ended with a card saying, Michael, we hardly used you, 2014 to 2014.
It was fantastic. It was a lot of fun.
So Jon Stewart was not angry with you for leaving after such a short period of time?
I don't think Jon Stewart has an angry bone in his body, man. He's a, you know, it's a unique fraternity to be a stand-up. I think everybody understands, you know, opportunity, and everybody is, especially at the top, are genuinely rooting for you.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Michael Che and Colin Jost, who co-anchor Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live. Can I ask you each to share one of the first jokes you ever told at the microphone? Oof.
Do you remember?
I remember the first one I wrote.
I don't remember the first one, but I do remember one that I was using like a lot, and it was bad. But go ahead, you can go.
Well, the first one I wrote was it's basically the whitest origin story for a joke. But I was playing golf, and it was like I was out in Arizona, and I was like,
and you're what, 20?
22.
Okay.
Something like that. 21. Uh-huh. 21. And maybe 20. And I played golf, and it was like the golf course was built on an Indian burial ground. And
that's the whitest thing you could
right.
say.
And there was a sign. There was like one section where if you hit a golf ball into it, there was a section that said, if you hit a golf ball in here, please leave the golf ball as a sign of respect. And I remember thinking, like, oh, I'm sure that there's a dead Native American chief who's thinking, wow, he left his golf ball on my grave. White people finally respect us. And then it was basically, the rule was basically like, if you hit a minority group with a golf ball, like at least let them keep the golf ball. Like the whitest rule.
That's actually good.
And then I was like, that got me through the first 10 horrible open mics. Was like, there's something there, right? I don't know.
And Michael, what about you?
Mine was nowhere near that. Mine was something about how Jehovah's Witnesses don't answer the door for, they don't celebrate Halloween, which is weird because that's the one time people open the door for you and they give you candy. It was real social satire.
And you fit in the most. You're like, oh yeah, there's a...
Yeah. I would think that would be their greatest holiday. It's Halloween.
Yeah, that's clean like up. That's like their Christmas.
That's their Christmas.
Everyone's being so friendly.
And also Christmas.
I guess also Christmas.
So one more question. As the anchors of Weekend Update, what is now the best and what is now the worst day of the week on a typical week?
Well, that's a good question.
I think the, well, they're to me, like, Saturday Friday and Saturday, as for update anchors, I think is the most exciting because that's when you're really getting the segment together. Like early in the week, you can kind of brainstorm stuff, but the news changes so much over the course of the week that you're kind of not fully into it till at least Thursday, just because you don't know how stories are going to change.
1 a.m. Sunday morning is pretty cool. 1 a.m. Sunday, because it's just such a release. I always liken doing SNL. It's like, it feels like planning a wedding every week. You know, it's like very special, and you get one real shot at it, and you just want it to go. You just want it to be done. You know, like not. Even if whether it goes well or doesn't go well, you just want to say, we did it. We put it all together. We put a lot of work into it, and we made it to air, and we finished the show. And that feels like an accomplishment even in itself, you know, because it's just so much to put a show like that together. And it's so exciting, and it's so much tension, and that at 1 a.m., you feel a big release, like we did it.
Michael Che and Colin Jost are the anchors of Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update. You can listen to a longer version of their conversation with Terry on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. Rock critic Ken Tucker watched the Country Music Association award show on November 4th and was very impressed with the duet between Nashville singer and songwriter Chris Stapleton and pop star Justin Timberlake. Ken's also been listening to the debut album from the band Old Dominion called Meat and Candy, and here's the album and the Stapleton-Timberlake duet as more proof that the definition of country music is becoming more elastic. Here's how Timberlake led into the duet on his song Drink You Away.
Nashville, how you feeling tonight? Can I put a little Memphis up in here?
Sweet thing, could just be a dream, or just the same nightmare that keeps me away.
Sing
it. Small shot of pain,
hey.
More than a lot now for the love that we made. And I feel it in the morning, ooh, you're still here in the morning. I see you, but you're gone, telephone a doctor, I'm not okay. The bottom of the bottle.
TV awards shows are usually planned and scripted to create crowd-pleasing moments that seem spontaneous, which made the high point of the recent broadcast of the Country Music Association Awards a real surprise. The night featured a series of rock and pop stars duetting with country stars, and on paper, matching the smooth Justin Timberlake with the sandpapery Chris Stapleton was an intriguingly quirky notion. Show co-host Brad Paisley introduced them by saying we would hear the Nashville sound meets the soul music of Memphis. He was right, and then some. The duo started singing Tennessee Whiskey from Stapleton's recent album Traveler, which I reviewed for Fresh Air. Then they segued into Timberlake's song Drink You Away, and you couldn't help but lean toward the TV screen, letting the pleasure and passion of the musicians pour into you. With harmonies from Stapleton's wife Morgan, they traded verses. Stapleton's rumble proved remarkably elastic and wry. Timberlake phrased like an R&B crooner and a soul shouter. Delicacy met power.
Oh, that's smooth. Tennessee whiskey. You're as sweet as strawberry wine. You're as warm as a glass of brandy.
Sick.
Honey, I stay stoned.
for love in all the same old places. Found the bottom of the bottle's always dry. But when you put out your heart, I didn't waste it. 'Cause there's nothing like your love to give me high.
The cameras panned across the audience of industry insiders and fans, which until that moment had been politely attentive. Now, they were on their feet, clapping to the beat, their mouths open, to sing along, to cheer, their faces creased with joy, happy shock. It was one of those moments when barriers of genre and hardened notions of what constitutes country or pop collapsed. A new band trying to keep those barriers down is Old Dominion, which has had a big hit with this song, Break Up With Him.
Hey girl, what's up? I know it's late, but I knew you'd pick it up. Nah, I ain't drunk. Okay, maybe I do have a little buzz, but that song came on and I just thought what harm could come from one little call. I know you say you're taking, but I say, girl, you're taking too long to tell them that it's over, then bring it on over. Stringing them along any longer, girl, is just wasting precious time. Girl, you know it can't wait, rip it off just like a band-aid. The way you look at me, girl, you can't pretend. I know you ain't in love with him, break up with him.
Old Dominion is a quintet of singer-songwriter musicians who, between them, have written hits for Kenny Chesney, Dierks Bentley, the band Perry, and songs for the TV show Nashville. Their album was produced by Shane McAnally, best known as a songwriter, in which capacity he is immensely successful, the current high priest of pop country. Together, they all make country music that shows the influence of hip-hop and dance music, and which can set the teeth of purists on edge. Check out, for example, the jittery stutter beat of Wrong Turns.
Stop and got a little gasoline of the old BP. Rolled around and wound up in the middle of BFE. Spinning these wheels down a road that we ain't ever seen. Who knows where we are? I get a little more lost every time I look in her eyes. It's hard to keep my hands on the wheel when she's looking so fine. I'll ride down any back road that she wants me to drive. See, laid back running, fingers through my hair, watching miles go by like she just don't care.
Meat and Candy is both an enjoyable and a calculated album, very clever and very self-conscious. It certainly has none of the spontaneity that made the performance of Timberlake and Stapleton at the CMAs so surprising. But Old Dominion's music shares with that TV moment a desire to upend expectations of what country music is supposed to do, how authentic country music is supposed to sound. It's not a revolution, but it's a welcome evolution, with the potential to become something more substantial and long-lasting.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. We're going to hear Terry's recent interview with Shonda Rhimes. She's the creator of the TV series Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, and she's executive producer of How to Get Away with Murder. Those three hit shows are ABC's Thursday night lineup. Rhimes is a major force in network television and in the greater landscape of American popular culture. With Grey's Anatomy, she became the first African-American woman to create and run her own network TV show. Scandal was the first network drama with an African-American leading lady in 37 years. Now Rhimes has a new memoir called Year of Yes, which is about the year she said yes to things. the kinds of things she'd previously said no to.
Shonda Rhimes, welcome to Fresh Air. So I'm not really sure how you survive having three shows on the same night. It's a lot of TV to be responsible for. What is your role now in each of those shows?
On Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, I am the writer, executive producer, creator. On How to Get Away with Murder, I'm just the executive producer.
Just, okay. Merely.
It's more like being the grandmother. You hold the baby, but then you get to give the baby back. Whereas the other shows, I'm responsible for everything.
Honestly, how do you keep so many characters and so many plots and subplots in your head?
I don't know. I mean, I've been doing it for a long time. So at this point, the two worlds are very clear and very set to me. And it doesn't feel like I'm juggling. It just feels like I'm going back and forth from one neighborhood to the next.
Do you ever worry about advancing to the point where you don't even get to write anymore? You're just like overseeing things. Is that something you want to prevent from ever happening?
Absolutely. I think my goal is to find a way to spend all of my time writing. I mean, sort of true success is I'm doing nothing but writing if I do my job correctly.
You have, I don't know if you still have this, but you've had a message on the bottom of your emails that you don't accept work emails after 7 o'clock or on weekends. Let me see if I can find it so I can, do you want to recite it or should I find it so I can read it?
I don't read work emails after 7 p.m. or on weekends. And if you work for me, may I suggest you put down your phone?
Okay.
That is what it says.
How do you do that? How do you not, I mean, the work day doesn't end until after 7 for a lot of people. How do you manage to just like turn it off at 7 o'clock and on weekends?
You know, it was a very hard thing to do, but two things have happened. One, I've learned to delegate a lot more. There are some very competent people who already know the answers to the questions, and they shouldn't have to feel like they have to ask me at this point. And they should have the right to make those decisions for themselves. And two, work will happen 24 hours a day, 365 days of the year, if you let it. We are all in that place where we're all letting it for some reason, and I don't know why. And it suddenly occurred to me that unless I just say that's not going to happen, it was always going to happen. And there used to be a time when we'd all get in our cars or our parents would all get on the train and come home from work, and that would be it. You'd get a call in the middle of the night if you were a doctor to deliver a baby, and that would probably be it. And why are we doing this to ourselves? There's nothing so urgent. That's what I found interesting. Since turning off my phone at 7 p.m., there's never been a thing so urgent that I regret having my phone off. None of these things is urgent at all. People think that it's urgent. But when in the long run, when you look at it, you think that's the silliest thing ever.
So when you say that you're turning off your phone, are you putting more pressure on other people to handle the problem, or are you giving them permission to turn off their phones too?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if we're not shooting, if we're not filming, if you're not standing on the soundstage, turn off your phone and go live your life.
Does it make you like your work more in the sense that it's not feeling as oppressive because you turn it off?
You know, I think I had reached a point where I felt a little bit resentful of how many emails I was getting. I get about 2,500 emails a day, by the way.
Are you kidding me?
No.
How much of that is like junk email and like catalogs and stuff like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, this is not junk email.
Wow. And
that doesn't include the junk email. And a lot of it's redundant questions because people want to make sure. Some of it's just getting things like call sheets or schedules or, you know, things for the shows. Some of it's notices that cuts have come out. Some of it's drafts of scripts. Some of it's, you know, BS&P notes from the networks. Sometimes you're just copied on other people's emails. But it's a ridiculous amount of emails. And the tension that that created for me, just seeing the sheer volume of emails in my email box, it was bad. And I thought, I don't want to get resentful. I really love my job. I mean, this job is pretty great. So if you can find a way to shut it off, shut it off so that when you come back excited.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Shonda Rhimes, who created the ABC shows Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, and How to Get Away with Murder. She's the executive producer of that. She is the showrunner and writer of the other two shows, and they are ABC's Thursday night lineup. She has a new memoir called Year of Yes. You write in Year of Yes that you had to learn how to use the power that you had once you became a showrunner, the showrunner of Grey's Anatomy. And an example of that is you were casting for the character that became Christina. Sandra Oh was the actor you eventually cast. But before that, there was another actor who I guess the network wanted to play that role, and you weren't really sold on it, but you were afraid to say anything. Can you tell us that story?
Yes. We had an actress, you know, before we'd even met Sandra Oh, there was an actress that everybody liked. The studio liked her. Betsy Beers, who's my producing partner, liked her. The casting director liked her. Everybody liked her. She was a lovely actor. And everyone wanted to cast her, and I did not. And it wasn't because she wasn't great. It was just she didn't, as I say, fit the key that turned the lock that made the story happen in my brain. And I couldn't reconcile it, but I was very afraid to say I didn't want her. And it was because I'd never done a television show before. And I had never sort of stood up and said, you know, no before. And I kept thinking, if I do, and everybody disagrees with me, something bad will happen. They'll either cast her anyway, and I'll realize I don't have any power here, or they'll fire me. You know, any number of things could happen. And I was really nervous about that concept. And in the end, Linda Loy, the casting director, called me up, and she said, if you cast this woman and she is in your show, it won't be your show anymore. It won't feel like your show, and it won't effectively be your show because somebody else will have made the choice for you. And so I had to get on a phone call with everybody and say, I do not want this woman on the show. I don't want to write for her. She's not right. And sort of stand up for my vision. And everybody was a little bit stunned, but they all said, oh, okay, and accepted it. And 2 days later or a day later, Sandra Oh walked in the door. And thank God she did.
How did you know she was right?
I can't tell you, but I knew almost instantly. And she came in to read for Bailey. She came in, read for Bailey, and I said, that woman is Christina. It was just, it's one of those moments when you just know something, and it clicked. She turned the key that fit the lock, you know, that made the story happen in my brain. And it felt correct for me.
Your shows have sex in them, and standards have changed in the past 15 years, or, you know, since you've been working on television. But I'm not sure which direction they've gone in, looser or tighter, or maybe back and forth. So tell us a little bit how the standards have changed about what you can say and what you can show.
There was a time before Grey's Anatomy started that ABC had NYPD Blue, and David Caruso was naked. You saw a naked backside on television. And that certainly was over by the time Grey's Anatomy came on the air. You could not do anything like that. That wasn't even a consideration when we started. But we did sort of have a nice layer of standards that I thought were good. I mean, you can be sexy without being, I don't know, inappropriate on network television. I always like to say our shows should be something that, you know, before 10 o'clock, if your kid wanders into the room, they should be able to glance at the TV, watch what's happening, but not quite know what's happening. That's always my standard. They shouldn't be sitting there watching it with you. But if they wander through the room and happen to see something, they shouldn't see something that, like, shocks them.
Do you envy the freedom that writers for premium cable networks have?
Sometimes, but sometimes not. You know, I always say, like, we're incredibly creative within our fences, because I don't feel like we're pushing boundaries. We're very creative within our fences. And because we have the fences, they make for very creative moments. We come up with some stuff that I don't think any of us would have come up with had we not had the fences. I never would have come up with the phrase vajayjay had I not had the fences. There's a lot of other things that I wouldn't have done visually had we not had the fences. And I think that they're better sometimes.
Okay, vajayjay, I'm glad you brought it up. I was going to, I'm glad you did. It's a name for a word you use for a woman's genitals.
Yes.
Why do you need to use it? Why can't you use the word vagina?
Well, we can, and we do. But we had reached a point at some point in, I think it was season 2 of Grey's Anatomy, where I think they'd said we'd used it too much or something. And I'd really had a problem with the idea that we couldn't use it, because we'd had an episode where you could say, we said penis 17 times or something. And
but who's counting?
Say that. they were.
Yeah, I know.
You could say that as many times as you wanted, but you could only say vagina a certain number of times before somebody just had a heart attack. And I was really upset about it. And I was like, this is a medical part of someone's body. It's a piece of someone's anatomy. We actually should be calling people's body parts what they are. This seems ridiculous to me that we're saying we're offending someone's sensibility by naming something that 50% of the population possesses. I don't understand. And they would not budge. They would not budge. And it was the Super Bowl episode that we were doing. And Dr. Bailey was giving birth. And I was like, she's a doctor. She's giving birth. And in the end, because there was just no more time, I had to come up with a different word. And the word we came up with JJ.
Your book is about your year of saying yes, because your sister told you that you don't say yes to things, you're always saying no. For example, what were some of the things you were saying no to that your sister thought you should be saying yes to?
It was almost everything. If I was invited to a movie premiere, if I was invited to a screening, if I was invited to a party, if I was invited to an award show, if I was invited to be on a talk show, if I was invited to give an interview, if I was invited to speak somewhere, it didn't really matter what the invitation was. Sometimes it would just be an actor would invite me to dinner at their house. I would say no. It was too much. Like, the concept of being out there and socializing and getting out into the world was scary to me, I think. And I hadn't been doing it enough. And I hadn't been out enough. So I'd just been going to work and coming home. And you don't realize how much of a rut you get into. But after 10, 11 years, it becomes a real rut. And you suddenly don't even know how to get back out into the world.
Was it because you were too busy or too uncomfortable?
I think it's both. I think first you're too busy. You know, at first I always say, like, you don't lose yourself all at once. You sort of do it, you know, like one no at a time. You start to get, you know, decline invitations because you're working too hard. And then you start to decline them because you don't really know everybody that well. And everybody else seems to know everybody really well. And then you start to do it because you haven't been out in so long that you feel uncomfortable. And then you start to do it because being at home feels really good. And then you start to do it because you have no other reference point.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Shonda Rhimes. She has a new memoir called Year of Yes. And of course, she's the creator of ABC's Thursday Night, Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder. I'm always interested in hearing how people decide what, if it's a conscious decision, what kind of family they'd like to have and how they go about trying to create it. You have three children. Two are adopted. One is through a surrogate. And you've done this as a single woman. At what age did you know that you were going to have children with or without a partner?
I think I've always known I was going to have kids. It's very interesting because I was talking to somebody else about this. It's a thing that's always been there. The same way the fact that I always wanted to be a writer has always been there. I've always wanted to have kids, and I always knew I was going to have kids. Was I ever going to get married? That was never there. That was like, maybe. But there was a very big certainty that I was going to have kids. I'm the youngest of six. I'm from a huge family. Everybody in my family has kids. There's like, I don't know, 17 grandkids already. And it's just the world that I grew up in that felt very clear to me that children were something that I definitely wanted to have.
At what age were you ready to say, I'm moving forward and doing it now? Like where were you in your life at that point?
I exhale because I'm gonna tell you this story that I love to tell, but I don't love to tell. I was, I think, 31 years old, and I had just broken up with some boyfriend, and I had rented a house in Vermont for a month, and I was going there to write and feel sorry for myself and hate boys. And I got on a plane and I flew out there, and the house was in the middle of nowhere. And the next morning, 9/11 happened. And so I was sitting in this house in the middle of nowhere with nothing but like a satellite TV watching what I thought was the world come to an end. And I thought, well, the world's going to end and I've done nothing. Like, I'm a child. I've done nothing. And I got out a piece of paper and I made a list of things I was going to do if the world didn't end. And at the top of the list was adopt a baby. Because I knew that that was like, I cannot have the world end and have never been a mother. I will be devastated. And the world didn't end. And I went home and I hired an adoption attorney. And 9 months and 2 days after 9/11, my daughter Harper was born.
It's really important to you as a show creator to have characters that reflect the diversity of American life. When you were growing up, did you feel like you had characters that you could identify with in the sense that, you know, of them being African American? I know there's many ways to identify with characters. I don't have to, you know, look like you or be from the same background as you, but it's nice to see characters who are from, you know.
Yeah. What's interesting is that I was saying this to somebody else the other day. Oprah was ruling daytime television.
Uh-huh.
Cosby was ruling nighttime television. Whoopi Goldberg was ruling Broadway, and Eddie Murphy was ruling the movie theaters in the late 1980s when I was a teenager and deciding that I wanted to be a writer for real. So to me, everything felt very possible.
Do you accept improvisation on the set, or is that out?
No, there's there's no improvisation because, as I said, the words exist as the words. We don't say words that are not written on the page. And we always say all the words that are written on the page. That's sort of our agreement. And I don't mean it as like we have this formal contract. It's just sort of the way it's always been. On Scandal especially, the actors treat the words as if it's a play. They feel like it's their job to figure out the meaning under the words and to just say the words. The words are not a suggestion.
Shonda Rhimes is the creator of the TV series Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, and she's executive producer of How to Get Away with Murder. You can hear a longer version of Terry's interview with Shonda Rhimes on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.